And so I took the provocative step of, well, first, thanks to the organizers for inviting me to give you this second talk during this workshop. So I'm crossing out the word avalanches. If you looked at the title, originally there was avalanches in the title. And so I hope that I can convince you that there is a different kind of long-range correlated behavior that is really distinct from the other kinds of avalanches that we've been talking about at this workshop so far. This is something that Mark Robbins alluded to during his presentation at the conference. And what I'm going to convince you is that in these systems of driven soft glassy particles, there is a robust connection between the diffusion and the rheology that comes from correlated plasticity that goes across the system that is not necessarily directly related to the avalanche behavior that you see when you drive the system very, very slowly. Okay, so you can see long-range correlated behavior without bursty intermittent dynamics, right? If you slow down, you still see the bursty intermittent dynamics, but I think we need to be careful to differentiate those two things before people have referred to these long-range correlations in the plasticity as avalanches. I'm going to make the distinction here and call them transient slip lines that appear in the system, which may or may not be related to the avalanches. And I'm going to show you that surprisingly, despite this robust connection between diffusion and rheology, the actual rate dependence of either of these things is really sensitive to how I put in dissipation in the microscopic model. And this sort of flies in the face of these ideas that we've been talking about in the last several weeks about these mean field models and what they have to say. Trap models, the Ebro-Lequeux model, where you have a site that goes over threshold and it yields mean field treatments of those kinds of models, would fail to describe this sort of dramatic dependence on how you put in the dissipation into the models at the microscopic level. And so this is what I was just alluding to. So if you drive these things slowly, you will see bursty dynamics, but if you drive them a little bit faster, you can kill the bursts, but you still get long-range spatial correlations. Then if you go even faster yet, you kill the correlations, and this is what affects the rheology and the diffusion. Okay, so, and originally in the abstract that I, or the title that I sent the organizers, I was going to talk about proximity to jamming. I don't think I'll discuss that since I only have a half hour here. Okay, so this was all done by my two students, Arka, who was here before in the program, who some of you met, and Kamran, who's now doing a postdoc with Jean-Louis Bras and Kristen Martins at Grenoble. Okay, so this is the stuff that I talked to you guys about 2 weeks ago, and then I will continue today and talk about the plasticity, the diffusion, and the rheology. I will briefly summarize the kinds of systems that I'm interested in. Like I said, T equals zero. I'm interested in suspensions of particles that are really athermal. So these could be, the particles could be solid particles suspended like in a paste. They could be liquid like in an emulsion. You have droplets in an emulsion, or you could have air bubbles in a foam or a mousse, many technological applications. I really want to think about the limit where there's no thermal drive. So unless I load the system, the particles aren't going to do anything. The particles are deformable, so all of the stress is coming from deformation at the contacts of the particles, nothing entropic, no rattling back and forth. And for what I'm going to talk about today, everything is going to be jammed. I'm confining the system, I'm confining the particles at positive osmotic pressure. That's what gives these packings their rigidity. If I let go, they fall apart. That's also interesting. I'm not going to talk about that here. Okay, so here too, this is a paper that appeared in Nature Materials. This was a collaboration between Michel Clough, who is doing the experiments, and Roger Bonacase at Texas, who is doing the simulations with his students. Jyoti Seth actually spent some time at ESPCI with Michelle, but she was the one who was doing most of the simulation work. And so these are microgel particles. They're like micron-size hydrogels. And you can change the temperature. You can make them swell and deswell, so you can control the volume fraction when you pack them in at fixed number density. And what they see, so I'm plotting the flow curves. This is the shear stress as a function of the strain rate, normalized by some quantities over here. And this is the same microscopic system. This is a collaboration between Arjun Yod, Jerry Golub, and Doug Durian with Paulo Aradia and their various students. Kirsten Nordstrom was doing this stuff. This is the exact same system of these micron-size hydrogel particles. And these guys were looking at varying the density, varying the volume fraction through the jamming transition. What they saw is that above the random close packing point, the flow curves at low strain rate went to a yield stress, but below that random close packing point at low shearing rate, the flow curves displayed some non-Newtonian rheology, but there was no identifiable yield stress. The Clot and Bonacase camp basically were always working well above the random close packing point, and they were measuring the flow curves. The point is that in either of these cases, you found a pretty robust scaling for the stress beyond the yield stress, and it went as the shearing rate to the 1/2 power. Okay, And so Bonnequet has basically developed this very detailed, what he called an elasto-hydrodynamic model, to try to figure out what the drag was between particles as they were moving past each other. Okay, and so this model basically set the lubrication pressure at the gap between the particles equal to the elastic pressure that he would back out from Hertzian contact theory, assuming that the particles were solid-like objects. Okay. It's a log-log scale. Both these are log-log. Okay. So this.
An exponent 1/2.
Well, I could try to extrapolate out. So you get so if you look at the scale here, going from the yield stress up to the largest shearing rates, you get about one decade, right? And so you could imagine over here, it has basically a shape that looks like a square root. Okay, you have a decade worth of scaling, I would say, more or less. And so over here, you could argue that. You still get basically, I would say, maybe a factor of 10. You're not quite approaching the asymptotic regime where you see that scaling. But okay, so take this with a grain of salt. But the point is that with this highly detailed model, the open symbols here are the, I don't even know which one is the experiment and which one is the simulation, but you see excellent agreement between the experiment and the simulation. Essentially, the only free parameter is the elastic properties of the particles. So you put in the viscosity of water, you put in the Poisson ratio of the particle, and you have the yield stress, and basically at these different densities, the model gives a very good agreement with the experiments. And so my question was, do you really need to get out this basic rheology? Question number one, do you need such a detailed microscopic model? Or can you get it with something a little more schematic? And then what can you tune in the model, if anything, to radically change the rheology that you see? Those are the questions I had, and here's what I did to answer them. So we have a very simple model that we're using. This is a variant of Doug Durian's bubble model that's been around since 1995. So everything I'm going to be talking about is in 2D. I've got big particles and little particles. The big guys are 40% bigger than the little guys. For everything I'm going to be talking about here, although I don't believe it's important at all, the particles are going to push apart with a linear spring. And there's going to be a drag force in this variant of the model. The drag force is going to be is going to be proportional to the motion of the particle with respect to some imposed background flow. Okay. So for this case, there's no mass. There's one time scale that's related to the dissipation, and I would measure the shearing rates in units of that time scale. And this is something that a rheologist would call a Deber number, right? So it's the shearing rate measured in terms of the relaxation time. And so we can ask, if I want to extend that a little bit, I can either add some mass and make it inertial, or I can put in different kinds of drag. I can either put in a drag as before with respect to the background imposed flow, or I can put in a drag where I'm damping the motion of the particle relative to its neighbors. This is one step towards the Bonnequet's model where I'm taking the hydrodynamics seriously. I'm taking the hydrodynamics a little more seriously here than I am here, but not quite in as much gory detail as the Bonnequet stuff. Okay, so obviously, if I introduce the mass, I have two time scales, and I can ask whether I'm overdamped or underdamped, and you can think about this sort of sector of four things. So I can either have where I'm putting in drag by damping the motion of the particle relative to the background, damping relative to the neighbors. I can be in an overdamped limit or an underdamped limit. Okay, and so what people have looked at before in 2009, Anna Lemaître and Christian Carolli basically looked at Leonard Jones at zero temperature with this sort of a pair drag. And so from my point of view, there's really nothing different. There's no difference, no fundamental difference between a Leonard Jones system at zero temperature and a dense collection of these soft particles. Okay. So now, big question marks. What happens if I take the Lemaître and Carolli model and crank up the drag so that I have something that looks more like these soft, squishy particles that Bonnequet was talking about? So I can go in this direction. And then the other question is, what happens if instead of damping the relative motion of the particles, I damp the absolute motion of the particles with respect to the background? Okay, and so I will talk about the connection. So what they found here is that in a Leonard Jones, zero temperature Leonard Jones glass, you get the same rheology as you do in the squishy bubbles, right? So you get that the shear stress goes like the yield stress plus something proportional to the square root of the shearing rate. And you also get, and there's a connection that I'm going to talk about later, a diffusion coefficient that goes down with the shearing rate like the shearing rate to the minus 1/2. And the connection between these two exponents is not accidental, and I will explain it, okay? Questions, please stop me.
The simulation theory?
I'm sorry, what, which?
The result in Gamma-Bit experiment.
Sorry, these are simulations. So with simulations, and there's, you know, there are arguments to relate this exponent to that exponent. Okay, so this is just what you get if you take the pair drag model and you put it in the you run it in the overdamped regime. So you see something very similar to the Kirsten Nordstrom's results from Penn, where if you're below the random closed packing fraction, you go to a non-Newtonian fluid. If you're above the random closed packing fraction, you go to a elastoplastic solid. You go to yield stress here. So for the rest of what I'm going to be talking about, I'm only going to be working up here at 90% volume fraction, well away from this jamming transition where I lose the yield stress. Yeah?
Do they seem to converge towards the same sort of universal curve, like large strain rates, or it's just like?
That's it. So the idea is that you can do a rescaling, right? And so the idea is that you should rescale. There should be a universal scaling function when you're on one side of the transition and a different universal scaling function on the other side of the transition, and they should go to a common limit, and that common limit has a scaling exponent of 1/2. Okay, so it's not an accident that these guys on the unjammed side of the transition all look like they're approaching the same gamma dot to the 1/2 behavior. Okay, so This looks fine on my computer, and I can't really see any of these lines. But so what we're doing, going from these curves going outward, I'm increasing the drag, and so I'm going from something that might be inertial to something that is likely overdamped. And so again, this is just the flow curve. I'm plotting the shear stress versus the strain rate. And here I'm measuring the strain rate in terms of the vibrational time scale. And here I switch and I'm measuring the shearing rate in terms of the dissipative time scale. This is the Deborah number. This is the only thing I would have if I had no mass. And what you see is that when you scale by the dissipative time scale, for these damping rates, I basically get a very good collapse for the three or four largest damping rates that I'm running at. Whereas if I back off on the drag, I go into some kind of underdamped regime. I still do not have the damping low enough that I converge to anything on the underdamped side, but I'm on my way. And so this is essentially the limit that Lemaitre and Carli had looked at before, the underdamped. We're now looking at the overdamped, and you see, and again, this is, you know, to address Thomas's question, you know, this is maybe a decade of scaling. Okay, so you can call that what you want, but it looks like it is consistent with the experiments on both the both the high volume fraction and the ones that are in the vicinity of jamming. So, you know, this is, like I said, this is a known result for the underdamped case. It's a new result for the overdamped case. So there's also one more thing that's new here. At high rates, there's actually a kink where something happens and I go to something that looks like a much less rate sensitive dependence on the shear stress. Then I will explain both why there's a 1/2 and how it's related to the diffusion and where this kink is coming from.
So for which rates do you get? Because one cannot see the numbers on the...
So in the dissipative time scale, this number is 1, okay? Mm-hmm. That's not important. Mm-hmm. What is important is the value of the diffusion coefficient when we get to this rate, right? And that will tell us that the diffusion coefficient has been reduced sufficiently such that the correlations in the system are at the particle scale, right? And that's where this kink comes from. So I'm basically shearing so fast at this point that I've killed all the spatial correlations of plasticity in my system, and I get a kink in the rheology. Okay, so this is what I just said, those are those words. So if I look at the long time plasticity at this point, and again, I really apologize, it looks fine on my computer screen. If you look at in space, I don't know if it'll help. I think it looks like a resolution issue. So it's a low. I think it's a relatively low resolution projector. But okay. So anyway, if you look at what in space is going on in the kink. So here I'm just plotting the vertical displacements of the particles. I have a shear flow like this. You can see in the movie. I'm pushing the top to the right. I'm holding the bottom fast. if you look at the vertical displacements of the particles, when I'm shearing slowly over a, if I make an image of the displacements over a time scale that's long enough for plasticity to accumulate, and I'll explain where this number comes from later, then what you see is that you have very long-range spatial correlations. All these red guys are moving up coherently. The blue guys are moving down coherently. I get a long line of slip that goes almost all the way across my box. This is what I see in the plateau regime when I'm near the yield stress. On the other hand, if I increase the shearing rate till I get up to this kink, it's right at that point where I saturate the correlations and I don't have anything left in space. And so essentially each region of the material is shearing independently from every other region. Okay, so this is what's causing this kink up at the top.
That's 3D, and how many particles do you have?
This is 2D, and it's a 40 by 40 system, so, you know, 1600 ballpark. It's not, we are right now looking at larger systems, but it is, we want to be able to get down to this yield stress plateau and explore that regime, and it, you know, because of the rate dependence, if you go to a bigger system, it takes a lot longer, so.
So it's a fast shift, yes. It could be the one where you trigger new things before other things that are going somewhere else.
No, so what I'll explain later is that even in this regime here,
yeah,
I may have killed all my avalanches, in the sense that if I look at the time response of the energy dissipation, I don't see anything bursty.
In which regime?
So for sure in this regime, I have nothing bursty left in time. But even in this regime, I can be shearing fast enough. There's an intermediate regime where I sort of squelch the avalanches, yet I still have long correlations in the plasticity, in the longer time plasticity. So that's, I hope I'll make that clear by the end of the talk.
These are constant pressure.
Volume. And so I'll show you, later I'll show you what the pressure is doing. It is doing something interesting.
Okay, and you will tell us what's that rate, the crossover rate, right? You will tell us that.
I will relate it to the diffusion coefficient. I'll relate it to the value of the diffusion. Okay. Okay, so anyway, so what's really going on? So when we shear slowly, and this has been known for some time, this is a picture from some work that I did with Mark Robbins in 2007. This is a Leonard Jones system. Again, I don't think it's terribly important. It's a much larger system. We're shearing it. I've sort of tilted these figures, so simple shear is this way. And I'm plotting the horizontal displacements. White means I'm going to the right. Black means I'm going to the left. Here I'm plotting the vertical displacements. White means I'm going up. Black means I'm going down. And you see that after, in this system that's much bigger now, 1,000 by 1,000, after a strain of 0.2%, I form one of these primary through-going slip lines in the material, right? One and only one of them in a strain window of 0.2%. Now, why am I showing you a strain window of 0.2%? So if you told me that when I drive these things slowly, how they accommodate the shear that I'm imposing is always by the formation of these slip lines that move by one particle. Okay, so my cartoon of what's going on is across in this direction. If I'm plotting, this is the horizontal displacements. Horizontal displacements is a function of the vertical position. I've got this sharp discontinuity in the middle. So I'm relieving an amount of strain that's equal to the slip amplitude, so that's the discontinuity between the white and the black, divided by this length, the system size, right? And so for this system, my system is 1,000 by 1,000. If I imagine that I'm slipping by one or two particles, that gives me about 0.2% of strain relieved right there. Okay, so all I have to say is that when it slips by one line going across the whole system, I have about a particle worth of slip across that line. Then you're relieving 1/L in terms of the amount of strain. Okay, so that's a characteristic strain scale. I'm sorry.
Where is that line, the slip line forming?
Anywhere. And so, I call these things transient slip lines to differentiate between shear localized things, between these and what people might call shear bands, because if I look at the next window of 0.2% strain, there will be another line that goes across the whole system, and it will be localized somewhere else,
so
completely uncorrelated to this one. Yeah. So I call these things transient slip lines.
Okay. This was what we were talking
about. Yeah. So these are two different slip lines and two different.
Nope. So this is the same instant. So I drive the thing to steady shear. I record positions at one time. I record the positions at a 0.2% strain later. These are the horizontal displacements. These are the vertical displacements, right? So it's significantly richer than I'm making out, right? So I'm telling you primarily what's going on is you get one of these guys forming in a primary sense across the system. And then what you can see is that there's another guy over here, right, coming across, And there's another little guy up over there, but for the most part, this guy here is the tail of that guy. But there will be one primary one, more or less, in every window of size 1 over L. That's what we see.
Did you plot the force chain as well?
But you're saying there's one primary one, so there is actually more than one slip line right here.
It's very complicated. So if I look, so what we also did is we looked at the power spectrum of the displacements, and it is tremendously complicated. So this, you know, so if you look at the power spectrum of this plot, it's a fractal with very strange, the power spectrum is a power law, and it has a different scaling exponent for every orientation in space, right? So we don't really understand geometrically how to describe these things. But for the moment, I'm going to wave my hands, and I'm going to say that basically what's going on is you get one line of slip that goes across the box, and it has a slip amplitude that's equal to the particle diameter. Okay.
And what is this picture on the lower right picture actually to the vertical?
This thing?
No, vertically. This way, in the dark line.
This?
Just start with this.
Yeah. That's this.
That's okay.
So what happens is primarily you have something that's slipping with a certain sense of vorticity, and if you look, you've got sort of cross-striking things that go across. And this looks like a lot. So the fact that you get these cross-striking things here, this is what, if you look at the structural geology textbooks, they would call this the toppling book mechanism. You have something with a primarily clockwise vorticity that's composed of littler things that have counterclockwise vorticity associated with them. Okay. But so again, it's complicated, but let's presume that we have one primary one.
And you said there is some dilation, right?
Not on average. I mean, there's a lot of, if I look triangle by triangle and ask which one's dilated and which one's compactified, there's a lot of activity in local dilatancy and compaction, but on average, nothing.
So you're saying, on average, we're doing,
but that's because you have concentration.
Yeah.
No.
Really?
I don't think so. You'd see the same thing at fixed pressure.
What do you
think? We've done that.
Oh, okay.
It's pretty good. Yeah.
But in experiments,
I see dilation,
right?
Depends who you talk to.
Yeah.
So you're thinking of Todd Hoffnagel's stuff? You're thinking
Todd
of Todd Hoffnagel's stuff in less. It depends who you talk to, and it depends, I think, on details that. Yeah. So in the Leonard Jones glasses, quenched very rapidly with high degree of initial disorder. We have not seen any persistent localization. We have not seen any dilatancy in these bands. That's why I call them transient slip lines, not to be confounded with shear bands.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so you asked a question about the stress. The stress is the force chains.
Yeah.
So what you would see is if I stopped this before this guy got all the way across, you would see if you looked at the stress change since the beginning of when things started to happen, you'd see something that looked an awful lot like an edge dislocation over here and an edge dislocation of opposite Berger's vector over there. But regardless, if I looked at the values of the stresses, not the change between the initiation of the event and now, you would just see noise, right? So the stress changes are very small compared to the fluctuations in the stress that are quenched into the structure, number one. And number two, if I let the thing glide all the way across the system, then somehow the stress is, healed itself, and I wouldn't really see anything. So the dislocations would basically get all the way across, they would annihilate with each other, and you'd be done. And you would see really no stress concentrations.
And you don't plot these other features vortices?
Well, you can call them what you want, right? They're cross-strike. So I, in geology, there's a name for it. When you have in California, you look at the map and you have a lot of right lateral faults and there are left lateral faults that join the right lateral faults. I forget what name, cross-striking, something like that.
Is there a length scale?
I don't know. Like I said, if we take these fields and we look at the power spectrum, it's a very complicated object that has a power law in every direction. It's obviously, so it has the most power in those directions, but it's not as if it immediately goes to zero in the other directions. So we're not clear yet geometrically on how to describe these objects.
So is there some correlation between the locations of the slip lines and different lines, or can you sort of like predict where the slip line will appear here?
No, that's what I, so what I just said is that after we go by a strain of 0.2%, essentially whatever was there before has exhausted itself, right? In the next window, you'll see it localized somewhere else at random in the system.
And you don't know where that is?
No. Okay, and so why, so what's the mechanism for the formation of these bands? Well, this goes back to something that we've had a lot of discussion about at this meeting. This is a picture from Jean-Louis. If you imagine that when the system yields somewhere, for whatever reason, what's going to happen? So suppose I yield at this purple site. If I think about how that yielding event affects the stress field locally, I'm going to increase the load to my sides and above and below me. I'm going to actually decrease the load and shield these guys over there, and you get a natural mechanism for triggering. These guys over here will want to slip, these guys over here won't want to slip so much, and that's what enables the formation of these lines where you get slip all the way across the system, okay? And so again, the formation of these slip lines is not to be confounded with bursty avalanches, and I will show the difference later. Okay, so just to get an idea about what, so now what I would like to do is I'd like to make a connection between the spatial organization of the slip and the value of the diffusion coefficient. And by diffusion coefficient, I mean really the mean square displacement of the particles, not the diffusion of the stress that we've been talking about before in the context of the various kinds of elastoplastic models. Okay, so if you imagine again what's going on, basically, you have one line of slip that's going across the whole system with amplitude A, and that these things add up incoherently over time, then the total amount of slip I'm going to get, so the slip on average in one of these events, I'm just taking the variance of this distribution, I get a factor of 1/12 just because I'm integrating the square of this thing, and I go from minus a half to plus a half. So if I'm adding these incoherently, the total mean squared displacement is going to be the number of these events times the mean squared displacement. In one of those events, I have to have enough events to relieve the strain that I've injected. This is an important argument right here. And then you see that the mean square displacement per event does not depend on how big the system is. If I'm always slipping by one particle, I could be in a 20 by 20 box, or I could be in a 1 million by 1 million box. If I slip by one particle, I'm giving everyone, on average, one particle worth of kick, right? Whereas the rate that these things occur at is much bigger in the bigger systems because they're unloading less strain in the bigger systems, right? So that's this argument. So at the end of the day, the mean squared displacement per unit strain goes like L, where L is the length of the box, times A, where A is the particle size, right? So you've got a dramatic increase in the value of the diffusion coefficient as you increase the box size, at least if you can remain in this quasi-static regime where you always have the slip occurring along these lines that get all the way across the box. Okay, and then we can look at these two extremes where we're shearing very slowly on the yield stress plateau, and then very fast where we actually kill all the spatial correlations in the plasticity. And so here I'm plotting the second and fourth moments scaled in a way, so I'm taking the I'm taking the fourth moment and I'm scaling it in such a way that it should be precisely equal to the second moment if we're Fickian. So these things should converge when I have a Gaussian distribution of displacements. And so you see that at early times, or I should say at short times, when I'm shearing fast, I have something that's very Gaussian, right? So my second and fourth moment are right on top of each other. And the second moment scales ballistically until you get a very sharp crossover to something that's diffusive. Okay, so this is like a gas. So when I'm shearing fast, the particles are essentially, they have a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution from the get-go. They collide, so there's some collision time, and then they diffuse. Okay. Whereas when I'm shearing very slowly, these particles have very, you know, any given particle has a very broad tail. The distribution is actually, there's a Cauchy distribution in the core with exponential tails. The exponential tails, people understand that those come from continuous time random walks, but you get something that's very, very heavy tails when you shear slowly. And as you go faster and faster, eventually all the correlations go away, then you get something that looks just like a gas. Okay. And so I will now relate this. So the gas-like behavior is that kink at high rates.
The sensitivity is actually higher than in the slow-driven case than in the plateau one.
I'm sorry?
It levels off at a plateau that is
higher. So this is the mean square displacement per unit strain, not per unit time. So if you wanted the actual diffusion coefficient, you'd have to multiply by one factor of shearing rate.
Oh, and in the end, it's going to be the same regardless if you shear it slow or fast?
No, so what I'm saying is that what you expect is that if you're in a quasi-static regime where everything is rate independent, then things, so the strain that you're injecting is playing the role of time, right? So if I went twice, if I went twice as slow, this number, mean square displacement per unit applied strain, would be the same. Right. Whereas when I'm shearing quickly, that's not necessarily the case, but I have these things scaled so that we would go to some common limit in the quasi-static regime. Okay, that's a standard thing to do. Okay, other questions? All right, so now let's look at the rate dependence. So here's how we cross over to the plateau and become diffusive. And so I should say that the crossover to this Fickian regime where my distribution becomes Gaussian and I start to obey, my second moment goes like the applied strain, this happens right at this magic strain that we talked about before, which is 1/1 the length of the box. So once I inject enough strain to excite one of these slip lines, that's when I cross over to the Fickian regime. Okay.
So in your indicator,
yeah.
Your velocity profile is linear.
I'm sorry?
Your velocity profile is
linear. On long times, always. Slow, fast, anything. So there's no localization. That's why I'm careful to call these things transient slip lines. So if I look on short time, you might see a band. Mm-hmm. But on longer time, since the band can be anywhere, it averages out. So the long time velocity, average velocity profiles are all linear. But for any short time window, you might have something that looks homogeneous. You might have something with a big slip line in it. Okay. Okay, so now if we look, so again, we're still in this pair drag model that's similar to what Lemaître and Carolee were looking at, and we're remaining overdamped. Let's look at the size scaling and the rate dependence. So this is for four different sizes, going from 20 by 20 up to 160 by 160. And if I look at this, and again, I'm calling it the diffusion coefficient. It's a mean squared displacement per unit strain, not per unit time. And so if I look at how this thing depends on the shearing rate, as I go slower and slower, eventually, as we expect, I saturate over here. For the bigger system, I know that my quasi-static value of the diffusion coefficient is bigger by this argument that I just showed you on the previous slide. It scales like the length of the box. So the plateau is going to be higher and higher, so it takes me longer to get to that plateau. So this purple blob there is my ab initio estimate that I just showed you on the previous slide. This is the essentially the L times A over now 24 because I'm doing the mean squared x plus the mean squared y. And so this ab initio estimate is really, you know, remarkably for putting nothing in other than the fact that I'm saying it's always slipping by something equal to the particle diameter. I get a value for the diffusion coefficient that agrees perfectly with the data. So to me, that's pretty amazing. And then if we look again at the rate dependence, it goes down like strain rate to the 1/2. Okay. And so this should ring a bell because we were saying the rheology, the stress was going up like strain rate to the 1/2. Here my diffusion coefficient is going down like strain rate to the 1/2. So are these two things related? So there is an argument due to Lemaître and Carolee, again in this PRL from 2009. So if you imagine that the system is accommodating the strain you're injecting by organizing into these lines, let's say that the lines have length psi, and they're relieving, again, they're slipping by something characteristic of the particle size. Okay, so you always slip by one. Then you can immediately just read off from linear elasticity what a displacement field would look like that was composed of these slip lines, and you would arrive at the conclusion that the diffusion coefficient goes like not the length of the box, but goes like the length of these lines, at least in the limit where these lines are much smaller than the box. Again, I think this is it's a pretty gross simplification because we know that the power spectrum of these displacement fields is complex. It has this very strange fractal nature. And so to just make these things linear, it's a little fishy, but it seems like the argument works. Okay, so that's what we're saying. So the diffusion coefficient, we're going to suppose, goes like the length of these lines. Then we're going to assume that the amount of stress that you are above the yield stress is going to go like the shear modulus times some kind of time scale times the shearing rate. And so this microscopic time scale is the time it takes to form one of these lines. Okay, and so this is essentially rigorous. If you told me that the structure of the displacements looked like this, I could tell you what the diffusion coefficient had to be. This is somewhat heuristic, and I think this you have to swallow with a big grain of salt. Okay, the fact that you're, so now we're going to say that this time scale for the formation of one of these lines scales like its length. Okay, I don't think there's no real good reason that I can see for that, but it turns out that it perfectly describes the connection between the diffusion and the rheology for this model. and a related model that I'll tell you about in a moment where the exponents are different. Okay. So what else do I want to say? So for this particular model, since we know that the diffusion coefficient I just showed you went like gamma dot to the minus 1/2, this would tell you that the stress minus the yield stress would go like gamma dot to the plus 1/2. Okay? So this is a connection between the structure of the plasticity at some shearing rate, the value of the diffusion coefficient, and the value of the stress above the yield stress.
Oh, wait, yeah. Two questions. How do you know that the diffusion coefficient is system size dependent? You have this log L over psi.
Yes, I'm sorry, what's the?
You know, there is a big dependence on L.
Yeah, and how come it's system size dependent?
L is not the system.
So here L is the system size. So there's a log correction that I'm ignoring for the moment from here on out. Okay.
Okay.
So in the quasi-static regime, there's a sort of a more schematic argument that I just gave you.
Okay.
This is the reason why the diffusion coefficient, when you're shearing the thing quasi-statically, goes like L. If you believe that when it's slipping, it's always slipping by one of these things that goes across the box and has a slip amplitude equal to the particle scale, then you're led to the conclusion that the diffusion coefficient should be this. There's an L in front, A is the particle scale, and this is the data, and this is this a priori estimate from that slide.
Okay,
so this all works out perfectly, and this was known, so essentially, so far we haven't done much. I'm just rehashing the argument due to Lemaître and Carolee. They had checked it for Leonard Jones with a very small damping. What I've done is checked it for these soft sphere models with a very large damping. And it looks like everything works out somewhat mysteriously the same. Well, this argument still appears to hold, and there's this connection between the exponent for the rheology and the exponent for the diffusion. But now let's switch the drag model. Remember, I was talking about these two drag models, one where I was damping the relative motion of the particles, the other where I was damping their motion with respect to the background flow. And so now I'm plotting the diffusion. Again, here's my quasi-static estimate. The quasi-static value does not change, but the rate dependence changes dramatically. The rate dependence is much weaker, so if I look at the diffusion coefficient, it's going down, now not like gamma dot to the minus 1/2, but it's going down like gamma dot to the minus 1/3. Okay? And here we can even bring in this, if I take my argument seriously, and I'm saying that modulo this log divergence, if I say that the diffusion coefficient is giving me some kind of estimate of the size, the lateral size of these slip lines, when the diffusion coefficient goes down to the particle scale, that means I've killed all the correlations in the plasticity. And so if I ask what it would mean for the diffusion coefficient to be down to the particle scale, if I just substitute D for psi, and I substitute A for psi, when is the diffusion coefficient down to the particle scale? That would be, for a box of a 20 by 20 box, this number would be 1 over 20. And so you see, when I get down to this level, where psi is equal to the particle scale, that's where I see a kink in the diffusion, and I see a kink in the rheology, right? So I can see in the rheology in the diffusion plot when the plastic correlations really get down to the particle scale.
Okay.
And again, the rate dependence is different for the local drag model and the relative drag model. For the local drag model, I get a minus 1/3, much less sensitive dependence than for the relative damping. And then if I look at what's going on, if I don't really believe that the diffusion coefficient is the whole story. If I try to be more quantitative about the structure of the displacement and strain field, if I read off the displacement-displacement correlation, so this is just the power spectrum of these pictures, right? So I'm looking at vertical displacements. I'm taking the power spectrum of the vertical displacements. Here it is. If I look at the real space correlations, if I decrease the rate, if I go slower and slower, at the highest rate, this correlation function basically saturates at something not so far away from the particle scale. As I go slower and slower and slower, this correlation length goes out and out and out, and eventually, when I hit the quasi-static plateau, when I'm slow enough that I'm up here, the real space correlation function saturates. Right? And so if you imagine what was going on was this canonical slip line, back to the cartoon. If you imagine what was going on in space with this canonical slip line, then the power spectrum of this thing should go like 1 over q squared if I just had a sawtooth wave for my displacement field. So the power spectrum is not quite 1 over q squared. It goes more like q to the minus 2.5. So again, these aren't perfectly line-like objects that are making it through my system. But nevertheless, it's not so far away. And if I look at the real space correlations and I ask whether they really are, whether this length scale is going like strain rate to the minus 1/3, it's not inconsistent. Okay, we don't have terrific data, but it's certainly not inconsistent. It's certainly the correlation length is growing as I decrease the shearing rate. Okay, so that was the diffusion, spatial structure of the plasticity. Now, the rheology, do we still have this connection? And I wouldn't be giving this talk if there wasn't a connection here. So yes, you get the same 1/3 exponent for the stress above the yield stress for the case of the local drag, right? And so what you can see here, I'm doing it again for several different damping coefficients. It's not terribly interesting, but as I decrease the drag coefficient, it's really difficult to get away from this overdamped regime. Okay, so for reasons that are still a little bit mysterious to me, it's very easy to be overdamped when I have the local drag, as opposed to the pair drag, where it was easy to get away from this overdamped regime. Okay, and so now you see, so this was Mark's question about whether I was controlling the pressure or measuring the pressure. So as I increase the shear rate, the correlations go down to the particle scale. There's a kink in the rheology. If instead of just plotting the shear stress, if I plot the shear stress over the normal stress, I go from something that's on the order of, say, 8% to something that's on the order of 30%, then I hit a plateau. And this is like a friction coefficient, and 30% is not so far away from stuff that you might see in an experiment on these squishy frictionless particles.
So what is your slow rate with respect to these curves?
Sorry?
What is your slow rate with respect to these curves?
You mean for the diffusion, when I cross over on the diffusion plateau? So we can,
The one that you say when you have the extended plasticity.
So I would say that, I could try to do a fit here to a straight line and get some value, but if you ask when am I crossing over and the real space correlation function actually saturates, here I'm going from 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 7 in terms of the shear rate measured in the dissipative time scale, and that would be somewhere over here, 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7. So I'm saying the two images I showed you where the displacement correlations had saturated at the low rate limit correspond to this stress and this stress over here. There is some rate dependence in the stress. Even though, and so this relates to Karen's question, right? What is the connection between these plastic correlations and the avalanches? Okay, so I'm in a regime where there's real valid rate dependence, yet the long range plastic correlations have saturated in the rate independent limit. Okay, so my plastic correlations are fully extended, and now I think the story about the avalanches would come in, right? And this is Thomas's question before, what do I care about the rheology out here? If we're thinking about yielding, shouldn't we be focused on what's going on near the transition, getting some, number of decades of scaling around that transition point? And I think this is where the story about the avalanches would pick up. And this is not necessarily the piece of the story that I'm interested in, right? So this is the universal stuff. This is sort of the, universally non-universal stuff, if you want to talk about that. This is what an experimentalist, this is what Bonnequet and Clot would measure. Is this stuff out here, and that's what I've been talking about in this talk, okay? But certainly the avalanches will become important down there, and if I have 5 minutes, boss?
No,
okay. Okay. I will just
can
say...
Can I ask
yeah, yes.
So when you have the crossover to the flat,
yeah.
The king, as you call it, this is in any experiment, so you have an idea of the race you need to.
So the dirty little secret that I didn't want to emphasize here is what I'm looking at when I'm making these plots of the rheology is just the elastic part of the stress. I am not plotting the viscous part of the stress. I fear that this effect will be completely swamped because of the viscous contribution to the stresses, which I'm not including in these plots and is sort of outside of the scope of the theory. Okay, so it's not hard to imagine that this would be, this piece up here would be completely blown off, and you might get something that's just pure Newtonian because you're picking up the viscosity of the solvent at that point. Okay. Okay. And finally, the avalanches. Okay, so I am looking at bursty energy dissipation. So how I do that, if I think about the derivative of the energy, so I'm increasing the energy because I'm shearing under the static stress, and also the particles are rearranging to dissipate some energy. And so if I identify this first piece here as the power I'm injecting, then I identify the differential as the rate of energy dissipation, right? And so in this particular model, now I'm going to talk about the local drag model in the overdamped limit. The energy dissipation is just going to be proportional since the velocity of the velocities of the particles are essentially following the force. It's going to be proportional to the elastic force on the particle squared, or equivalently to the total square amplitude of the fluctuations in the velocity away from the background, right? And so if I plot this as a function of time, this is essentially going to be something akin to an acoustic emission spectrum or something like that. Okay. So this is, oh, wow, this is terrible. What can I do about that?
I can draw it on the board.
I can draw it on the board. So, if capital gamma is the energy dissipated per unit strain, and I'm plotting this on a log scale, and little gamma is the current strain, just to give you an idea. So this, I'm going in this picture from 35% strain to 40% strain. I'm in steady state. And on a log scale, I have a baseline here of something in the ballpark of 10 to the minus, I can't even see it, my screen has changed resolution too, so I can't, let me try this. Let me just do this. Is that better? Can you sort of, well, here, let me do this. I'm trying to zoom, but I can't zoom because it's in the weird display mode. The usual zoom isn't working. Okay. All right, so anyway, so you see that the baseline here is around, well, now I need my axis. All right, so the baseline is around between 10 to the minus 3 and 10 to the minus 2. And the peaks are up here at 10 to the minus. So this is 4 orders of magnitude change in energy dissipation rate. So what you see is there's some baseline of a characteristic rumbling. Okay, and so the level of the baseline is set by the non-affine elasticity in the material as I'm loading. Right. So this is not plasticity. This is rate-dependent viscoelastic relaxation that I put into the model. Whereas these guys up here are clearly plasticity. And if we look at the, okay, so this is similar in spirit to the way that Carmen Miguel analyzed her data on the dislocation burst models. I'm just looking at the making a histogram of the instantaneous dissipation rate. I'm not trying to separate events into discrete avalanches. When you're shearing continuously, this is a nightmare, and I don't even know how to do it in principle. So Mark Robbins was saying at the conference that he avoided doing that. I'm trying to do this. I don't know if it's because I'm brave or I'm foolish, but I'm trying to do it anyway, and here's what you get. So when you go, and I'm scaling the energy dissipation rate by the shearing rate, so that this baseline here will collapse if I'm in a regime where I have well-defined periods of elastic loading. Okay. So what you see is that for these very lowest rates of 10 to the minus 6 and 2 times 10 to the minus 6, I get a well-defined peak at low dissipation rate that corresponds to those periods of time when the system is being quiescent and just elastically loaded, right? And it's well separated from this power law regime of the elastic dissipation events. So the point is that I can go from 10 to the minus 6, 2 times 10 to the minus 6, 5 times 10 to the minus 6, and by the time I'm at 5 times 10 to the minus 6, I've completely obliterated this power law regime, right? So I'm going from the red to the blue to the green distribution, and then at 10 times 10 to the minus 6, I really see I'm almost Gaussian by then. And so if I think about what's going on in terms of the diffusion and the rheology, I've killed all the bursts by the time I'm even off the diffusion plateau.
Well, what's the power law in the power law regime?
I should have known that you would ask. And so we had discussions a long time ago, and I'm not sure how to relate this to the other exponent that we see when we define individual events.
I think we have an idea on that.
B equals one means that this, so this is a drag. So I basically have the dissipative time scale set to the vibrational time scale. No. Sorry, it's not the exponent.
Yeah, that's
what. It's in the ballpark of minus 1.2, I think.
Okay.
So take that with a, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know how to relate that to the exponent that you get when you actually drive the thing quasi-statically.
I think we have some idea on that.
So. Okay. So we should talk.
Yeah.
But I frankly, because I'm interested in the non-universal stuff outside the scaling regime, I just care about the fact that I see a regime where the avalanches go away, but I'm still on this plateau in terms of the diffusion, right? So there's still long-range plastic correlations in my system. Okay, so if I look, if I go back to the diffusion, I'm sorry, this is a poorly engineered talk. If I go up to 10 to the minus 5, I'm still here. And I showed you that going from here to here, I've killed all the avalanches in terms of looking at the instantaneous energy dissipation rate. And I see nothing bursty in time. Everything is very smooth in time, and the energy dissipation spectrum is Gaussian. Okay, so I will stop there and spare you all, but the moral of the story is that we looked at these two different drag models where I damped the motion of the particle relative to the background or relative to its neighbors. This, not surprisingly, is exactly like the Leonard-Jones glass that Lemaître and Carolee looked at. Here, more surprisingly, when I crank up the damping, I still get the same thing, and if I go to this other drag model, I get a different value of this exponent here, but I still have this relationship between the diffusion and the rheology. And then for reasons that are a little bit mysterious, I can make the damping very, very weak, and it's still tricky if I'm in this local drag model to converge to something like an underdamped inertial regime. Okay, and so I'll stop there. Questions or lunch? Lunch, probably.
Questions at lunch.
Or questions at lunch.